The golden age of radio is on the air. Morehead State Public Radio presents classic old-time radio programs from radio's golden age, the 1930s through the 1950s. On this program of the golden age of radio, the story of the Bell Witch on WSM Tall Tales from 1953, the Burglar of Blackpool on Incredible But True, and the radio quiz show Information Please. Stay tuned for the golden age of radio after today's news from NPR on WMKY 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY 90.3 FM. Later on today's show, The Burglar of Blackpool on Incredible But True and the radio quiz show Information Please. Right now, the story of the Bell Witch on WSM Tall Tales from 1953 as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Get team, get on there. Ho for Tennessee.
The wagons creak under the heavy load. One, two, three of them. Piled high with household goods. Family sure collects a powerful lot of stuff in 20 years. Including, naturally, a passel of young'uns. Up there on wagon number one, John Bell is driving the team. John Bell's a big, stern, God-fearing man of just past 50. Taking his family west to Tennessee. They've left North Carolina far behind. John Bell has a land grant waiting for him along Tennessee's Red River, up near the Kentucky border. 1,000 acres of rich bottomland.
Zadok, Betsy, you watch out for Joel and William. See, they stay close to the wagons. They're taking it awful good, John Bell. Uprooting's easier for saplings than for old trees, I guess.
Now, Lucy, keep your head turned west. No sense in looking back on bumblebee cotton and nubbin' corn.
Like a curse on us, it was. Green fields turned brown as December grass. Just overnight. Like a curse, John.
We're peaceable, pious folks, Lucy. Curses don't concern us. That's Granny Woman's talk. To scare the young'uns of a stormy night.
You don't believe it? Well, I do. There's something evil hovering here about. A thing that's... well, it's a haunt. The Bell family's bewitched, John.
Witches? Haunts? You and me, well, we're like John Bell, aren't we? We don't believe in such things. And then, out of the dark comes a tapping sound. And a strange, eerie kind of music.
I comb my hair with a rip saw and I wash my hands in lye. Oh, the devil, he's my older brother, and me, I'm too mean to die. Oh, I'll haunt you east, I'll haunt you west. I'll make your cabin a wild mare's nest and pinch and scream till you get no rest. But you'll never know just why. But you'll never know just why.
Phew! Scares me just to think on it. She was terrible mean, that witch was. Of course, John Bell's family tried to keep it a secret that such a curse was in the house. Only, you just can't keep something like that a secret very long. Folks up and down the Red River country heard about the terror over at the Bell farm. Some of them came to see for themselves. It was, Hattie, Mr. Bell, Miss Bell, just come by to renew old acquaintance. But you and I know they were there to crane their necks and listen. They gave the spirit a name, the Bell Witch, and my, how they talked about her.
She's a little green woman who hangs from trees. The Bells Betsy saw out in the sycamore grove.
I heard her scream at old John Bell. Call him names that'd turn a raftsman's stomach.
She throws dishes and pulls hair.
And she sings hymns and repeats scripture. Why, James Johnson heard her, and that's a man who knows his Bible. She told him, button up, old sugar mouth, and let somebody who knows the book have a say.
Naturally, folks started looking around for something bad John Bell might have done. Had to be a reason, they figured. And so the gossips went to work. Of course, they found one. Several reasons, in fact. Back in North Carolina, John Bell killed an overseer on his farm. That's what some folks claim. The overseer was cussed and mean as a skunk, they allowed. Still, killing him was murder, and so John Bell was haunted. Tush and Shaw, said others, no such thing. The Bell Witch is nothing but old Kate Batt's ghost, her that John Bell bought that section of land from. Remember how she bellyached over the price he paid? Cheated me, John Bell did, she swore. And I'll come back from the grave and torment him after I die. You pays your money and you takes your choice, I say. Maybe there wasn't any reason at all. Or leastways no reason that mortal man could think up. You know, that'd be real torment to be deviled all your life and never know why.
Oh, witch can help you, but if you refuse, you'll find green lizards inside your shoes. And the more you gain, the more you'll lose. But you'll never know just why. But you'll never know.
About this time, a young schoolmaster came a-courting John Bell's Betsy. He was a likely young man and clever at books. The Bells liked him fine, and John Bell asked him to stay on and teach in the log schoolhouse just built on his farm. That made two young men with a fancy to marry John Bell's Betsy. The other was Joshua Gardner, and Betsy's blue eyes shone like raindrops on a cornflower whenever Josh came around. The Bell Witch didn't cotton to Josh Gardner. He laughed at her, and when a man laughs at a witch, he makes her madder than a wet hen.
Now look here, Betsy Bell. Once and for all, you and me are getting married, no matter what that invisible old busybody says or does. I don't care if she's the old Nick's kin or only a gall-darn prank of nature. We'll pay her no heed.
Well, you can see how the Bell Witch wouldn't care for the likes of that young man. She made poor Betsy miserable with cuckle burrs and hair pullings and torn dresses. Pretty thing liked to cry her eyes out at such devilment. Meanwhile, the Bell Witch was nagging old John Bell, too. From sun up to dark of day, she ranted and cussed and threw dishes. She even brought along four other evil spirits to help her. Black Dog, Psychography, Mathematics, and Jerusalem, she called them. What a bunch. They promptly went off to a grog shop and got roaring drunk. And that psalm-singing Bell Witch, she went right along with them. Strange to tell, the witch didn't seem to bother all the Bell family, just Betsy and old John. One time, John's wife Lucy took sick and was lying on a bed, white and sad, with her hands open on the counterpane. She was just drifting off to sleep when she felt something in her hands.
Oh, John Bell, come look. Sweet grapes and strawberries in my hands. And it's January outside. And who's that a-singing so soft and low? Betsy, is that you?
But it wasn't Betsy singing. And where would any mortal get sweet grapes and strawberries in January? Now, they say that down in Nashville, word of these strange doings reached the ears of a skinny, high-tempered, adventuresome gentleman named Jackson. Andrew Jackson. Can't you just hear what Andy Jackson would have to say about a thing like the Bell Witch? It burned the ears off a blacksmith. Old Hickory gathered some half-dozen young bloods together and headed north for the Red River country. Jack Busby was one of them. A fair, proper dandy was Busby, and a know-it-all. And he said he'd give the Bell Witch her comeuppance even if she was a devil straight from hell. Right off, soon as Jackson's carriage crossed the Bell property, the wheels locked. Andy Jackson raised 7 cans of cane with the driver, but the carriage just wouldn't budge. Pretty soon, there came a screeching voice out of thin air, and it said,
"All right, General, you can go on now, but I'll see you again."
Sure enough, she did, for it must have been the Bell Witch. She twisted Jack Busby's nose and pushed him down a flight of stairs. She railed and cussed at every man in Jackson's party till the bunch of them lit out for Nashville, glad to escape from the bedlam raised by that invisible harpy. "By the eternal," Jackson roared, "I'd rather fight the British again than have any more dealings with that torment called the Bell Witch."
"I'll haunt you north, I'll haunt you south. I'll put hot ashes inside your mouth and waste your fields with creeping drought. But you'll never know just why. No, you'll never know just why."
One day they found old John Bell slumped over in his chair. On the floor beside him was a bottle of poison. Nobody knew for certain how it got there, but they talked hushed-like about when the strawberries had appeared in Lucy Bell's hand. A spirit that could produce strawberries in winter wouldn't have any trouble at all putting poison in John Bell's house. Poor fella. Right after that, the witch quit the Bell family. 7 years went by without a sign of her, until the day Josh Gardner was about to marry Betsy Bell. That brought the Bell Witch back again, fit to be tied. She thumped Betsy black and blue, told her she'd make her life a hell on earth if she married Josh Gardner, and she sealed the argument with a terrible yank on Betsy's long yellow hair.
"Pay heed to my solemn warning, all you of John Bell's line. Oh, no. Whene'er you cross a witch's pleasure, you will reap a witch's sign. Oh, I'll haunt you north, I'll haunt you south. I'll put hot ashes inside your mouth and waste your fields with creeping drought. But you'll never guess just why."
Poor Betsy. She gave Josh Gardner back his ring, and a little while later she married the schoolmaster. And the Bell Witch, who stuck around long enough to make sure Betsy followed her advice, summoned up a storm cloud, caught hold of a bolt of lightning, and vanished in a clap of thunder. The last words anybody heard her say were,
"I'll be back in 100 years with trouble enough for everybody."
Then she was gone.
"I'll haunt you east, I'll haunt you west. I'll make your cabin a wild man's nest and pinch and scream till you get no rest. But you'll never guess just why. But you'll never guess just why."
"I'll be back in 100 years, she said. Let's see. Why, that might be today.
Tall Tales, a retelling of famous Tennessee legends. Tall Tales is heard each Tuesday evening at the same time. Tonight you heard the story of the Bell Witch, Next week, Jenny Lind in Nashville. Tall Tales was written by Bill Woolsey. The storyteller was Bobby Wiener. The ballad singer, George Grice. Produced by Marjorie Cooney. Tall Tales comes to you from WSM, the National Life and Accident Insurance Company, Nashville, Tennessee.
There were tears in her eyes as she told me goodbye. Then she walked down that road of no return. If it hurts to see her go, a broken heart must never show, for she's walked down that road of no return. She was mine through the years, now I can't claim her. Though my heart's filled with tears, I'll never blame her. Now another has her heart, but from mine she'll never part. Though she's walked down that road of no return. Someday she will grieve, but she's walked down that road of no return. If someday a memory burns, and in her heart for me she yearns, she'll regret that road of no return. She was mine through the years, now I can't claim her. Though my heart's filled with tears, I'll never blame her. Now another has her heart, but from mine she'll never part. Though she's walked down that road of no return.
The Midland Bank in Blackpool, England, is what is known as an eminently sound institution. And the only dubious incident which mars its long and honorable record of service is the one that occurred on August 6, 1926. It was on that Saturday, at high noon, when the doorman was just closing the doors, that one of the Midland's regular clients entered the bank with a large bag under his arm. He was Mr. Lloyd Fenwick of the Corporation Tramways Department.
Morning, Mr. Fenwick.
£800 in here, all treasury notes.
I'll make out the slip for you, sir. But you'd better open the bag yourself.
I don't know who else could open it. Got a new type of lock on it. No one could possibly open it unless they know the secret, and I'm the only one who knows it. I've got another bag out in the motor van with all the silver in it. Safe enough to leave this one on the counter, I suppose.
Oh, yes, of course. Just leave it where it is, sir.
As he turned away from the cashier's counter, Mr. Fenwick noticed that the bank was still quite crowded. Nevertheless, since it was now past the noon hour, the doorman had locked the doors to prevent latecomers from entering. As he unlocked them for Mr. Fenwick, the tramway's official remarked,
"No need to lock up again, my friend. I'm coming right back in."
But the doorman was a man of caution. During the few moments that Fenwick was gone, he stood by the closed doors, his hand on the key. When the official returned to the cashier's window, he carried another bag, smaller than the first one, in his hand.
We'll count the treasury notes first, sir, if you don't mind.
Makes no difference to me. Well, give it to me. Your bag with the treasury notes. You must have put it away.
I? Oh, no, sir. It's lying right over here where you... Good Lord, sir. It's gone.
Yes, the black leather bag had vanished from the cashier's counter. What's more, it had vanished from the bank itself. The police were summoned, but a most thorough investigation failed to reveal its whereabouts. Fenwick, the cashier, and the police themselves were utterly mystified. At 3 o'clock that same afternoon, Patrolman Cook was strolling down Needham Lane, just a block away from the Midland Bank.
Hello. Someone must have lost a bag. I say now. Could this be the one what's missing from the bank?
Tucking the bag under his arm, Patrolman Cook made his way quickly to the central police station. And there, while one of the officers got in touch with the tramways department, the others took turns trying to open the lock. But the lock refused to yield. They were still working over it when Mr. Fenwick arrived.
This is it, gentlemen. I only hope the money's still there.
The lock's still closed, isn't it? That simply means no one could open it.
None of us here could make the blooming thing work, sir.
No? You just take hold of it like this, see?
Aye.
And you insert the key. Good Scott. The treasury notes. They're not in the bag.
Though every indication pointed to the fact that the bag had not been opened, that it could not possibly have been opened, nevertheless, the money was missing. And while this was remarkable in itself, it was no more remarkable than the bag's disappearance from the bank through a door that was locked and guarded. The £800 were never found. And neither was the solution to the strange mystery. A mystery incredible but true.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio in an episode of Incredible But True. We also heard Ray Price sing The Road of No Return from 1952 and the story of the Bell Witch on WSM Tall Tales, first broadcast on radio on October 6, 1953. Stay tuned for more classic old-time radio from the 1930s through the 1950s when the Golden Age of Radio continues on Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY 90.3 FM. Right now, enjoy the radio quiz show Information Please as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Information Please. Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts. Here's how you do it. Send us questions on any subject under the sun with the right answers. Each question we accept wins you $2. Our experts guarantee to answer every one of them correctly or pay you $5 for each one that's too much for them. You figure it out. You can win as much as $7 per question if you're brighter than we are. Our master of ceremonies is Clifton Fadiman, literary critic of the New Yorker magazine. Mr. Fadiman.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. Good evening, everybody. Our authorities this evening are the usual four in number. Franklin P. Adams, columnist of the New York Post. John Kieran, sports expert and dendrologist. Hiya, Denny. Make up the regular half of our quartet, and they'll be supported by Mark Duffield, day news editor of the New York Herald Tribune, and by our guest of honor, Mr. Oswald Jacoby, widely known as a top-flight bridge expert, but who I understand knows a lot about other things as well. This is our chance to find out. Also yours, Mr. Jacoby. Now, gentlemen, the rules. They're very simple. Raise your hand if you think you know the answer. A question composed of no more than two parts must be answered by one man. But if it has more parts than that, the board may cooperate. If any part is answered incorrectly, we lose $5. When you hear that cash register ring, that means the questioner is getting his $5. And ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience, remember that Information Please is unrehearsed, free as the wind, unpredictable as tomorrow's newspaper. Let's go. The first question comes to us from Summit, New Jersey, from Miss Elizabeth Bigelow. Miss Bigelow wants you to give the present-day slang that parallels these expressions of the past, and there are five of them altogether. One, 23 skidoo. Mr. Jacoby.
Scram.
Scram is right. There's another one, perhaps not as modern as scram.
Beat it.
Beat it, yeah. That would be about 1932. When would you say the 23 skidoo was popular? Do you go back that far?
1905.
About 1905. What month, Mr. Adams?
In June, from Little Johnny Jones.
That seems accurate enough. I'll accept that. Two.
I think it was the 8th.
I knew we'd get it. I knew we'd get it, folks. The, here's an old expression from the past. Fiddle face. One I'd never heard before. Fiddle face. Fiddle face. You can guess on these, gentlemen, if you wish. I'll take a good guess. Going, going.
Durante, the Durante type.
Would be fiddle face?
No, but I think that the expression I'm trying to think of has to do with Durante.
Big news.
Scazzola. Yeah.
No, no, that wouldn't be quite right. Fiddle face and sourpuss would be exactly the same. That's one wrong. Three, sparking. Sparking. Mr. Duffield.
Necking.
Necking is quite right. That was very quick, Mr. Duffield. Thank you. Four, some pumpkins. Some pumpkins. Mr. Duffield.
Big shot.
No, I don't think that would be quite so good. I can think of one which would be more accurate. Some pumpkins. Mr. Adams.
A pip.
That's about 1929, I think. I mean really modern. Hot stuff, I think, would be an approximate parallel to it. Hot stuff. And five and last, this is up your alley, Mr. Duffield. Kiddo. Kiddo?
Hot mama.
No, I won't let hot mama go while I have the opportunity to keep her. Yes, Mr. Jacob.
Babe.
Yes. Or even more modern than babe, maybe.
Toot.
Yes, hiya, toot. That's right. I think it's usually prefaced by hiya. Well, that's going to cost us $5. We got two wrong out of five on that. $5 to Mr. Bigelow. Very good question, I think. The next one is from Miss Rosalie Canselmo of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She wants you to supply the last names of each of the following famous authors. I'm going to give you their first names. There are five of them all together. One, George Noel Gordon. Mr. Kieran.
Lord Byron.
Lord Byron is quite correct. Two, Pelham Grenville. Mr. Adams.
Wodehouse.
Wodehouse is quite correct. Three, Alan Alexander. Mr. Adams.
Milne.
A.A. Milne, that's right. Four, Charles John Huffam. That's a sticker.
How do you spell it?
Charles, you know how to spell Charles.
Yes, but that...
You know how to spell John.
Yes.
Huffam, H-U-F-F-A-M. Charles John Huffam. I think the Huffam has got Mr. Kieran puzzled. Got to get 4 out of 5 on these. Let that one go. Mr. Adams, do you have a flash? No, Mr. Adams has no flash. Mr. Kieran has no flash. The answer is Dickens. Charles John Huffam Dickens, his full name. And five, Herbert George. Herbert George, Mr. Adams.
Wells.
Wells is quite correct. Herbert George Wells, H.G. Wells. Well, that's going to cost us... No, that's right. They got 4 out of 5 on that. Just got by the skin of their teeth. The next one from Mrs. Archie B. Dorrance of Albion, New York. This is a tough one, and I think a rather important question. Mrs. Dorrance wants you to give the important event, at least very highly newsworthy event, that happened on each of the following dates. And again, you have to get 4 out of 5. The first date is March 5th, 1933. March 5th, 1933. Mr. Jacoby.
Roosevelt was inaugurated.
That, I'm afraid, is wrong. That's one wrong, Mr. Duffield.
The banks were closed.
Yes, the bank holiday declared by President Roosevelt. You got the character right, Mr. Jacoby, but the event wrong. It was Mr. Roosevelt, but it was a bank holiday. The second one, now we have to get them all right from now on. December 10th, 1936. December 10th, 1936. Not allowed to give you any hints on this one. Not allowed to give you any hints on any of them.
We can consult on this question?
No. Cooperate does not mean consult. And don't nudge him either, Mr. Kieran. Give that one up. A very famous event indeed. The abdication of King Edward VIII took place on December 10th, 1936. The third date, May 28th, 1934.
May 28th. Mr. Duffield.
I have a feeling that the Dion quintuplets had something to do with that.
Yes, they did. Five important events. They were all born on May 28th, 1934. That's quite correct. Mr. Duffield is something of an authority in the Dion quintuplets. He follows their career.
Can't fool me now.
The fourth question. I beg pardon, Mr.
You can't fool me on them now.
No, I know that. Fourth, July 18th, 1938. July 18th, 1938. Fairly recently. Mr. Kieran, I somehow feel you ought to get that one. No? The answer is that Corrigan landed in Ireland on July 18th, 1938. Well, that's three wrong. Now the last one. January 20th, 1937. Mr. Jacoby.
You can't beat me on Roosevelt twice.
No, I can't. What's the answer?
Second time you got inaugurated.
Yes, the inauguration of Roosevelt, the second term. What's unusual, Mr. Jacoby? Mr. Jacoby, what's unusual about that January 20th date for an inauguration?
That was the first inauguration of a president after the lame duck amendment.
That's quite right. Ordinarily, we inaugurate on what date?
Ordinarily inaugurate about January 20th from now on. We used to inaugurate on March 4th.
Yes,
or the Monday
following. That's quite right. Well, that, I'm afraid, is going to cost us $5 going to Mr. Dorrance of Albion, New York. A tough question. Now, the next one involves two sports. Mr. Jacoby, would you call contract bridge a sport?
Wasn't this afternoon. Usually it is.
Usually it is. Well, I don't know whether we ought to call it a sport, a business, or a mania, but the following question involves both baseball and contract bridge. Mr. Malcolm C. Sherman of Marshfield, Massachusetts, wants you to mention five terms or expressions that are used in both those games or sports, both in baseball and in contract bridge. Mr. Kieran.
A double.
A double. What would it mean in bridge?
Oh, a penalty challenge to a person who has made a contract. You claim they can't make it, and...
Right, Mr. Jacoby. Mr. Jacoby is our court of appeal on this.
Right.
Mr. Jacoby, how about another one?
Pass.
A pass would be perfectly all right. That's two. Mr. Jacoby, another one?
Take out.
I beg pardon?
Take out.
Oh, take out a man?
Yeah, take out a partner.
That's all right, yes. That's three. Two more. Mr. Adams.
Diamond, but I don't know whether they use that in bridge or not.
Mr. Jacoby, they do use diamonds and bridge, of course.
13 of them.
Yes, there are 13 of them. That's enough. Yes, diamond, of course. Very good. That's four. One more, Mr. Kieran.
A club.
A club. Yes, very good. And there's another expression they use at the end of a long bridge game, Mr. Jacoby, which might also, one word of which might also be used in baseball. Yes, Mr. Adams.
Home.
Yes, that's right. It's about time we went home. Did very well on that. Got five. The next question from Mr. Angus Gillespie of Great Neck, New York. Oh, this is one of my favorite kinds of questions. Mr. Gillespie wants you to sing or quote, note the caution of Mr. Gillespie, sing or quote the answers to the following questions based upon old songs. Now, there are four of them. One, where did Clementine live? Don't all answer at once. Mr. Jacoby, do you want to sing or quote? Make
up
your mind.
Sing.
I beg pardon? You've never tried.
I have tried, with no success whatsoever.
All right, Mr. Jacoby, you can quote it if you be so good.
In a cabin by the river, which flows beside the mine, so on. You want to get
in a cavern, in a canyon.
In a cabin, in a canyon. He's got the cabin, that's good enough. In a cabin, in a canyon, excavating for a mine, lived a miner, 49er, and his daughter, Clementine.
Right, she wasn't like a fairy.
Pardon?
Like she wasn't like a fairy.
And the shoes were number nine.
Get off this, gentlemen. I can't have you singing Clementine all evening. Two, where did McGinty go? Where did McGinty go? Mr. Kieran.
Down to the bottom of the sea, dressed in his new suit of clothes.
That's right. Three, where am I when weeping for darling Nellie Gray? Oh, this is a sad one. Mr. Adams. Mr. Adams looks the most melancholy of the four. No, Mr. Jacoby.
I am sitting by the river and I'm weeping all the day.
Very good.
Which is gone from the old Kentucky shore.
Pretty good. Do you boys, when you play bridge, also sing?
No, it's bad enough without it.
I think it is. Four, where is Dinah? Where is Dinah? Raise hands, gentlemen, if you know. Mr. Jacoby again. He's a bear of this sort.
State of Carolina.
Yes. Dinah, is there anyone finer in the state of Carolina? And just off the record, gentlemen, can you give me the answer to this one? Where doesn't Annie live? Mr. Kieran.
Annie doesn't live here anymore.
That's right, Mr. Kieran. Four out of four. Very good. The next one from Mrs. E.L. Bagley of Plainfield, New Jersey. This is an odd one. Mrs. Bagley wants you to identify the following Indians. You know what an Indian is, Mr. Adams?
An American Indian?
Yes, an American Indian, yes. I don't mean the Gandhi kind. I mean the sort of people you meet outside of cigar stores. An American Indian. Now, there are five of them all together, and you have to get four out of five. The first is Tecumseh. Tecumseh, T-E-C-U-M-S-E-H. Who was Tecumseh? Don't know that one. Oh, they all do. Mr. Adams, Mr. Jacoby, Mr. Kieran.
Well, he was an Indian chief who fought way back about, I should say, roughly 100 years ago against the American forces.
Yes, that's right. Under the British in the War of 1812. Very famous Shawnee chief. That's quite correct. Two, Powhatan. P-O-W-H-A-T-A-N, Mr. Jacoby.
The father of Pocahontas.
Yes, famous as the father of Pocahontas. Three, Konkapot. K-O-N-K-A-P-O-T, Konkapot. You have to have read something, gentlemen, to know the answer to that.
That's the name of a Pullman car on the old CB&Q, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Duffield, for that very interesting piece of information. Probably quite true. Sorry, I can't let it go.
Leatherstocking Tales.
No, that's just a guess, wasn't it?
The only Indian books I never read.
Now, you hold on. We may come to that. No, it's one of Rogers' Rangers in a novel called Northwest Passage by Kenneth Roberts. So that's one wrong. The next one is Chingachgook, C-I-C-H-I-N-G-A-C-H-G-O-O-K, Mr. Jacoby.
Chingachgook was the father of Uncas in The Last of Mohicans by James Fenimore Cooper.
Yes, there we got our other stocking tales in, that's quite correct.
The now son of the great Unamis.
I beg pardon, Mr. Kieran?
Chingachgook was also a son of the great Unamis. Unamis.
Unanimous?
Unamis.
Unanimous. And five, got one wrong so far, we have to get this one quite right. If we're going to get by, Phi Tonto, T-O-N-T-O. Tonto? Oh, this is simple. Tonto. Don't know that, Mr. Adams. Mr. Jacoby. Four radio stars.
Tantalizing, isn't it?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Duffield. Mr. Jacoby.
He was the Lone Ranger. He's Lone Ranger's cut Indian.
Yes, that's right. He's kind of the Lone Ranger. Well, we almost had the Indian sign on you gentlemen then. Well, we got just four out of five. Just getting by tonight. The next one from Miss Ida Marks of New York. You're asked to complete the following couplets, which are all taken from The Bad Parent's Garden of Verse, a book of verse by Ogden Nash, famous humorous poet. The first one is simply called Baby, and it goes this way. A little talcum is always...
welcome.
That's right, Mr. Kieran. Thank you very much. To the parent. Children aren't happy with nothing to ignore, and that's what parents were
for.
I have to have the line exactly, I'm afraid. And that's what parents were. This actually has rhythm and scans. And that's what parents were, Mr. Kieran.
Give us the first line.
Children aren't happy. Children aren't happy with nothing to ignore, and that's what parents were.
Designated for.
I won't let it go. That's approximately it. And that's what parents were created for. We must be exact in the case of Mr. Ogden Nash. That's one wrong. The next is called Pediatric Reflections. Many an infant that screams like a calliope could be soothed by a little attention to... Mr. Kieran.
Podiatry.
No. A nice guess. Many an infant that screams like a calliope could be soothed by a little attention to its diope. All should know that. Two wrong out of three. $5. Not so good on children, gentlemen. Not so good on Nash. We've lost $15. See whether you can retrieve your reputation in the latter half of the program. Next one for Mr. George Ritchie of this city. Gentlemen, if you walked into the following fictional houses to be found in works of fiction, whom would you expect to see? Have to get 4 out of 5 on this. One, a schoolhouse in a hollow. If you walked into a schoolhouse in a hollow. This is a fictional house. Mr. Kieran.
Well, Ichabod Crane.
Ichabod Crane, from what story?
The Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
That's quite right.
Washington Irving.
Very good. Yes. Want to tell us any more?
No. Tell you the story with gestures.
Bet he would, too. Two, if you walked into a roundhouse which contains the Cannonball Express, whom would you expect to see? Mr. Adams.
Casey Jones.
Quite right. Three, if you walked into a hothouse in New York City filled with orchids. Mr. Kira.
Walter Venchel.
No, I don't think I'll let that one go. You might, conceivably. Mr. Duffield.
It's an S.S. Van Dyne character.
No, you're next door from
it. Oh, I can.
Mr. Kieran.
Nero Wolf.
Yes, but we have to call it wrong all the same. Got that on third try. Now we have to get the next two quite correct. If you walked into Sis Callie Fluker's Bowden House in Birmingham, Alabama, whom would you expect to see, Mr. Jacoby?
Florian Slappy.
Florian Slappy from what stories?
Octavius Roy Cohen.
That's quite right. You read too, Mr. Jacoby.
Barely.
Pretty good. And if you walked into our boarding house, whom would you expect to see? Our boarding house. Mr. Kieran.
The autocrat of the breakfast table. Oliver Wendell Holmes.
No, I'm specifically...
Well, that would be my boarding house.
Well, I'd like to let that go, Mr. Kieran. Mr. Jacoby.
The major.
Which one?
Major Hoople.
Major Hoople, yes, in the famous cartoon character. Well, I hate to paste up a $5 loss on you, but to be absolutely accurate, I have to do that. $5 going to Mr. George Ritchie. Tough question, I think. The next one for Mr. William McGarry of Brooklyn, New York. Mr. McGarry wants you to supply an appropriate slang term, which is the name of a food, for each of the following. For example, nonsense would be what?
Nuts.
Yes, or baloney. Now, here's one. An easy and lucrative job, a sinecure, especially a political sinecure. The name of a food designating that, Mr. Jacoby?
Plum.
A plum would be quite right. Two, a slang term for aggressiveness or brazen assurance. Name of a food, or any part of a food, for that matter, Mr. Kieran.
Hard-boiled egg.
Hard-boiled egg? I think I'll let that go. Yes, I think I'll let that go. Hard-boiled eggs, all right. Thank you, Mr. Kieran. Crust is the one I was thinking of. Three, a dandy or fop. Dandy or fop. You have to go back a century or two to get the proper slang term for that one. Mr. Adams. No? Mr. Kieran.
Macaroni.
Macaroni is quite correct. In the 18th century, that was the term for a dandy or fop. Four, to complain over much or unduly. Would be Mr. Adams.
Beef.
To beef, yes. Or another word, Mr. Duffield.
Crab.
Yes, beef or crab. Mr. Jacoby.
Grouse.
Pretty good. Grouse is good. That's a bird. Five, impudence or insolence. Mr. Duffield.
Sauce.
Sauce is quite correct. Four out of five, very good. Think of any other besides sauce?
Applesauce.
All right, Mr. Kieran, thanks very much for the amendation. The next question, from Mr. A.W. Robinson of Birmingham, Alabama. What presidents of the United States during the 20th century were, or are, ardent fans of each of the following? Fans or devotees of each of the following sports or activities. One, boxing. What president associated with boxing, Mr. Jacoby?
T.R.
Yes, Theodore Roosevelt, quite right. Two, medicine ball. Mr. Duffield.
H.H.
Oh, these initials are exactly why. H.H. You know, I remember... Who could... Mr. Duffield, help me out on that one.
You recall him Herbert Hoover.
Herbert Hoover, yes, that's right. Herbert Hoover. Three, detective stories. Detective stories. Mr. Adams.
T. Woodrow Wilson.
T. Woodrow Wilson. Well, what was Mr. Woodrow Wilson's first name?
Thomas.
Gee, he knows everything. That's wonderful. Thomas is quite correct. Not even part of the question. Four, swimming and sailing. Swimming and sailing. Mr. Jacoby?
The other Roosevelt.
Yes, Franklin D. Roosevelt, quite correct. And five, and last, peanut eating. Peanut eating. Mr. Kieran.
Calvin C. Coolidge.
Calvin Coolidge, that's quite correct.
John C. Coolidge.
That's five out of five. They know their president. The next one, from Mr. Harry Kerr of New York. He wants you to name four books, each of which has one of the following card games in its title. And there are four altogether, and you have to get four out of four. This isn't so easy. Name a book with the word bridge in it. Mr. Jacoby, the bridge expert.
The Bridge of San Luis Rey.
And that required reading in your field?
Never read it, but I heard the title.
Bridge of San Luis Rey, and who wrote it?
Thornton Wilder.
That's quite right, Mr. Jacoby. Mr. Duffield, do you have another one? In mind?
No, he stole my bridge.
He crossed his bridge before you came to it. Two. Casino. 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 See no reason why that should stump you, gentlemen. Don't like that. All right. Mr. Kieran, Casino?
I think it has a murder story with the name Casino on it.
You have to name the title. Sorry.
I just saw the title. I don't remember. I give up.
Give up on that one? Have to get four out of four on this. Mr. Adams, do you remember any novel with the word Casino in it? Mr. Jacoby, you don't play Casino, I suppose. Baby's game.
It's a good game, but it's not a novel.
Played. You haven't read that game for a long time. It's the Casino Murder Case by S.S. Van Dyne that you were thinking of, Mr. Kieran. One wrong. Now, I think there's only one answer possible on the next. Poker. Poker. Mr. Adams.
The Outcast of Poker Flat.
That's quite right. By whom?
F. Bret Hart.
Yes, you wouldn't accept Pocahontas, would you, Mr. Adams?
I would.
Oh, you would accept Pocahontas. Hey, she's in good mood tonight.
She's dead.
I thought you'd make me give that back to the Indian. Well, here's the fourth. Hearts. 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 I can give you one in German. There's a very famous book by Heinrich Heine known as, I think it's Harz Reise, Journeys in the Harz Mountains. But I won't accept it. For myself, either.
What about Hearts and Flowers? Did they ever make a book?
It's a song. I don't think it's a book. If I find that it is a book, I'll give you credit.
Thanks.
And get your slip at the door.
Okay.
No, there are only two that I can think of at the moment. One is Hearts Enduring, a novel by John Erskine. And another is Hearts Desire. By Emerson Howe, or Huff. Which would it be?
Huff.
Huff, beg your pardon. We got two right and two wrong, and that's going to bring $5 to Mr. Harry Kerr. Tough question. The next one from Miss Ruth E. Furla of Elberon, New Jersey. This is going to take us back. Oh, I don't know how many years this is going to take you, gentlemen, back. How many years back do you want to go, gentlemen? Make your choice.
Pocahontas.
Oh, all right, we'll go back all the way to Pocahontas, Mr. Adams. I'm going to ask you to complete each of the following rhymes. Complete each of the following rhymes that come from old autograph albums. You know those things that used to have velour covers on them? Mr. Kieran remembers that. Got a fond look in his face. Take that fond look off your face, Mr. Kieran. One. When you get married and live upstairs. Remember the line that followed that in the old autograph album? When you get married and live upstairs. Mr. Kieran?
Well, the last part of it is don't put on airs.
That's right. That's half of it. Don't sit. Don't sit. Oh, if you could only give me the first half, how happy I would be. Don't sit by the window and put on airs. Give you half credit on that one. Two. Have to get four out of five on this. Think of me by the river. Think of me by the lake. Think of me by the river. Think of me by the lake. Oh, that's a famous old one. About 1907, Mr. Adams.
Before my time.
Before your time. Think of me on your wedding cake and cut me a piece of cake. Don't you remember that? Well, you've had no love life, gentlemen.
No album life.
Three. My love for you shall never fail. My love for you shall never fail. And there used to be a picture that they used to draw, I think, after that one. Mr. Eric Kieran?
I'll take a guess. Until this wedding cake gets stale.
No. You let it go. All right, I'll let it go. You wish? Four. I wish you health. I wish you joy. I wish you health. I wish you joy.
Blessings on thee, barefoot boy.
Oh, no, Mr. Kieran. No. Mr. Kieran, you're making up your own album this evening. I wish you health. I wish you joy. I wish you first a baby boy. Pretty sentimental, huh? And last, oh, this one you ought to know. Don't like that, Mr. Kieran, eh? Five, read upside down and you shall see. Read upside down and you shall see. Oh, gentlemen, what an unfortunate childhood you've all had. Awfully sorry for you. Read upside down and you shall see that I love you as you love me. Still don't recollect it, Mr. Kieran. What were you doing at the age of nine on June 31st? Well, that's going to cost us $5, going to Miss Furler of Elberon, New Jersey. See if we can get some of the next question in. The next one comes from Mr. Joseph Altshuler of Cincinnati. Identify the following personalities prominent recently in the news, and that means very recently. Get four out of five on this. First, Prince Henri Count de Paris, or Prince Henry, Count of Paris. Take your choice. Mr. Duffield.
He flew back from Belgium to France to try to get the throne back for the French pretender.
That's quite right. To Lord Craig Avon. Lord Craig Avon.
British ambassador somewhere.
No, sorry. Not quite British. Prime Minister of Northern Ireland. Three, Paul Henry Spaak. S-P-A-A-K is the way that's spelled.
He's a big shot in Belgium.
Yes, how big?
Fairly big, medium-sized.
Oh, yes, he's as big as they come. He's the premier. And General, Yu Han Mu. Yu Han Mu. Sorry. No time. See if you can get the next one. Pedro Aguirre Cedra.
New president of Chile.
Yes, elected president of Chile. And Yu Han Mu is the military governor of Kwantung province, who surrendered Canton to the Japanese. Well, that's going to cost us $5, too, going to Mr. Al Chula. And now I'm afraid that's all we'll have time for tonight. Information police seems to have lost how much? $30. Next Tuesday evening, the board of experts will consist of Mr. Adams again, Mr. Kieran, Mr. Oscar Levant, and as our guest of honor, Mr. W.E. Woodward, famous biographer of Washington and Grant, and of a forthcoming biography of Lafayette. And your master of ceremonies, ladies and gentlemen, will be ably replaced, more than ably, for this one broadcast only, by the famous playwright, George S. Kaufman, author of innumerable Broadway hits and co-author of the current success, The Fabulous Invalid. And now, Mr. Cross, will you take the mic and remind our audience of the rules once more? Information, please, thanks you and asks you to come again.
Thank you, Mr. Fadiman. We meet again next week at 8:30 for another battle of the public versus the experts. Please send us questions, any number of them, with the correct answers. And don't get worried if our editorial staff changes or edits your question slightly. Remember, $2 per question if we use it, and an additional 5 spot if it stumps the board. All questions become the property of Information, Please. Send them to Information, Please, NBC Radio City, New York. Until next Tuesday evening at 8:30, good night, all. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.
You know, it seems to me that mothers get smarter and smarter all the time. For instance, in the old days, when it came time to wean the baby, some mothers would switch to ordinary bottled milk. They had a time of it, too, because the baby was used to pet evaporated milk. And he had some pretty definite ways of telling Mom that he didn't like any change in diet. Well, these days, mothers don't have that trouble at weaning time. They just keep baby on pet milk, and everything's rosy. Baby likes pet milk in the bottle, he likes it in the glass. And even more important, the very same protective substances in pet evaporated milk that help babies build sound teeth, strong, straight bones, and make sturdy, steady growth helps youngsters through all their growing years. Yes, it's getting so in happy homes throughout the country. Youngsters have safe, easy-to-digest pet milk from the time they're born till they have pet milk babies of their own. Which is probably one reason why there are more happy, healthy youngsters today than ever before.
The Golden Age of Radio on WMKY, the radio quiz show, Information Please. This has been the Golden Age of Radio, classic old-time radio programs from the 1930s through the 1950s. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows, on the web at archive.org. Tune in again for the Golden Age of Radio next week at this same time and channel on WMKY at 90.3 FM and online at WMKY.org.